We take a look at stories from around the state this week as part of our Wisconsin News Roundup. First, a UW lacrosse student is criticizing the school's response to sexual harassment allegations against a professor there and says more students are coming forward with similar experiences. Hope Kerwin is a WPR reporter based in lacrosse. Hope, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to do it.
Well, the first allegations against this professor in the art department there came to light on September 4th, I think. Can you remind us about what we know?
That was when UWL student Casey Bean first made her public Facebook post accusing an unnamed art professor of sexual harassment, and also saying UWL officials did not communicate with her after she filed a report about this professor last spring. She said there was no communication until she came back to school this fall and then followed up with the staff. Just simply kind of told the results of what happened with that professor, but little information was given to her.
And now we're hearing about maybe more potential cases of harassment from the same professor. What's coming out now?
Yeah, so the same student, Casey Bean, released another statement this week detailing more of her experience with this professor, and also saying that students had been in contact with her, sharing similar experiences or similar stories with this same professor. And UWL Chancellor Joe Gao did confirm that additional information had been brought forward from other people to the investigative team that is this investigation into this professor was reopened, kind of in light of the public outcry around Bean's Facebook post. But UWL officials, as of Wednesday, said that there were no formal additional complaints filed against the professor at this point, but more information coming to light.
What has the school said about their long-term handling of the initial complaint?
UWL officials have said that the initial lack of communication with Bean as far as the results of the first investigation, that was an oversight, that was a mistake. And then they have said that they have reopened this investigation, and they're also involving UW system into this investigation as kind of an external reviewer. You know, they have not released a lot of information. They say they can't because it's a personnel issue. But UWL Chancellor Joe Gao was very clear. He wanted people to know that this investigation is ongoing, and they hope to speak more about it when they had the results.
And Hope, finally, you talked to an expert on these type of cases and how universities handle them, not specifically about this case, but about how campuses set up their guidelines and reporting and things like that. What were some of the key takeaways there?
Yeah, I spoke with Abigail Boyer from the Cleary Center, and she basically said that it's not uncommon to see victims of sexual harassment or other people in these sorts of situations wait or even choose not to report people who they feel has attacked them or harassed them because they often know the person in this situation. Casey Bean kind of addressed this in her statement, saying that she continued to see this professor on campus and, continue to have him for classes after the incident.
Hope, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Hope Kerwin, WPR reporter in lacrosse. She talked to us about reports of sexual harassment allegations against a UW lacrosse professor. Now, the toxic pollutants known as PFAS have been a problem for people in the Marinette and Peshtigo area over the last few years. Now, the state DNR is holding 6 listening sessions for people to voice their concerns. The first was held this Wednesday. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob, how you doing?
Good. Well, 6 listening sessions here. Pollution there due to the company, due in large part, it looks like, to the company Tyco Fire Products. Can you remind us of what's been happening the last couple of years?
Yeah, so in 2016, the DNR began investigating PFAS at the Tyco Fire Products fire training facility. And, you know, after there was a lot of national attention over the use of some products like firefighting foam that have these chemicals known as PFAS in them. And so they were concerned that these chemicals might be making it off-site and into groundwater and surface water in the area. And they did find the presence of PFAS due to that firefighting foam that was used there. And so they have been working with the company that's been doing some testing of private wells and waterways to determine the level of contamination there.
And you write that the DNR and then Tyco's parent company, Johnson Controls, are in a disagreement over water testing. What's going on?
Yeah, so in July, the DNR asked Tyco to expand its testing of private wells and also expand that to farm fields in the area where treated sewage sludge had been spread because it's often good for helping crops to grow, and it's a pretty common practice elsewhere. But this treated sewage sludge may have contained PFAS because the city's treatment plant had informed the DNR that they had found high levels of PFAS in their intake lines. So the thought is that, you know, the sludge that had gone through there and been treated may be containing contamination that resulted from firefighting foam that was discharged from Tyco Fire Products fire training facility to the wastewater treatment plant there.
And has the company changed its operation when it comes to disposal of its products since the pollution from its site became well known?
Yes, they have. They have changed their practices. In March last year, they suspended all foam wastewater discharges to the city's treatment plant. They spent about $1 million to seal its lines leading to that facility. And they've also are spending around $3 million to treat and get rid of biofouls that the city's been holding on to since 2017 in the next couple weeks.
We'll leave it there for now. Danny, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. She joined us to talk about a public meeting held by the DNR last night on contamination from PFAS chemicals in the Marinette and Peshtigo area. The next session will be at the Marinette Community Rec Center, October 16th at 6 p.m. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Wisconsin news roundup in a few moments. We'll check in on an effort to bring back a long-closed theater in Stevens Point. And first, a check-in on a bizarre news story in Wisconsin. Rob Menser is WPR's Rural Communities reporter. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Thanks.
Well, let's start with the story of a fugitive who was recently captured in the Wausau area after hiding out in a bunker for 3 years. First of all, give us some background to this kind of unpleasant case.
Yeah. So Jeremiah Button is a 44-year-old man from Portage County, and he was charged with repeated sexual assault of a child as well as possession of child pornography and some related charges. The crimes happened in 2014, and in 2016, he was scheduled to go to trial, and he was free on a $25,000 bond when he disappeared.
And it turned out, this was discovered recently, he'd been hiding out in a bunker. How was that discovered?
Yeah, so a hunter was out on public land. This is in Marathon County, just east of Wausau, near the Ice Age Trail, actually. And this hunter was out. He came across this door to this bunker that had been dug into the side of a hill. And it turned out that this was the place where Jeremiah Button had been living for the last 3 years plus.
And now he's back in custody. What has the effort been like to go through this bizarre underground hideout?
Yeah, it took – so I talked to a DNR expert who was involved in this. It took a team of more than 10 people about 2 days to go through everything, which meaning, you know, separating out anything that would be used as evidence, taking care of any potentially hazardous materials, and then sending most of it back to the landfill. Mostly what this guy did was he lived off – materials, foods as well that he was able to scavenge from the Marathon County landfill, which is nearby to the site. But he had set up a power generator that ran on a stationary bike. There were solar panels, so he had a television and a radio inside this very weird, tight, little sort of like a root cellar type of space, this small underground sort of bunker space.
Now, he is in custody now. What is the latest on his case? So where is it in the courts?
There's a bit of breaking news this afternoon, Rob, that so he has pleaded guilty to they reached a plea deal with prosecutors and his defense attorneys. So he will plead guilty or has pleaded guilty to the repeated sexual assault charge and a child pornography charge. He'll be sentenced in October, according to the agreement. This is being reported this afternoon. The the district attorney and his defense attorney will both recommend 30 years in prison.
And I want to switch gears, Rob, to a lighter story you've been covering, but important to community. The Fox Theater in Stevens Point, vacant for a long time, on the verge apparently of being demolished. What was happening, Rob?
Right. So this is 19th century theater right in downtown Stevens Point. It opened in 1894 as the Grand Opera House. And it's been closed. It's been vacant for quite a long time, decades, actually. And then in April, this nonprofit group called Create Portage County announced like a very ambitious plan to renovate the space and turn it into this sort of creative community hub. And they had a $3.5 million renovation plan. They were just starting on a capital campaign. And then in late July, a city inspector said that the problems with the building were so serious that if they weren't addressed in 90 days, the whole building would need to be torn down.
Okay, so that set a timer. What happened to save it from that demolition?
So as of this week, the Stevens Point City Council voted to contribute $250,000 to the project. What I talked to the executive director of Create Portage County, Greg Wright. So his view is they had just launched their capital campaign and they had even already obtained some grant funding. And he feels good about where that fundraising campaign was going. But it's like not. You know, it's not like ready cash that he could use to write a check to a construction company. So this funding from the city will allow them to line up contracts with construction companies to address these immediate structural issues. So with that in place, that means that the immediate threat to the project is removed, and they'll be able to turn back to the rest of their fundraising campaign and the other elements of this this project that they have in mind.
Is there any thought on the timeline for this rescued theater now to become this hub in the community?
So it's likely to take a couple years yet. I think it's a bit unclear whether they'll be able to get the actual construction done this year. Sometimes scheduling that can be a challenge. So it's more likely that work will end up being done in the spring. And so then that only just sort of is the triage work, and the real renovation will follow. So I mean, this is a multi-year type of project, but they're really fired up and excited about this kind of like business incubator, maker space, community hub space that they have been operating in a temporary space, and excited to make the former Fox Theater its permanent home.
Rob, thanks for bringing us this story from Stevens Point.
Hey, thanks.
That's Rob Metzer, WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. He helped us close out our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. Earlier this week, we talked about proposed changes to Wisconsin's livestock siting rules. They cover things like how far manure storage needs to be set back on farm properties and ways to manage runoff. We heard from the Dairy Business Association, which says some of the changes on the table could prevent farmers from being able to grow their operations. Today, we hear a different perspective. Kara O'Connor is Government Relations Director at the Wisconsin Farmers Union. They think the rules are a step in the right direction. Kara, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
The rules as they exist for livestock siting and expansion, where do you and the Farmers Union see them falling short?
Let's go back to how this all began. In 2006, the state legislature dramatically circumscribed local government authority over livestock operations. That meant that the ceiling for things like setbacks, engineering standards to make sure that nutrients and manure wasn't running off of feedlots, the fees, all of those were – the ceiling for all of those was set at the state level, and local governments in most cases were prohibited from going beyond even when the need required. And as time has gone on, problems have emerged. I want to emphasize that many livestock operations are great neighbors, but in places where problems have emerged, local governments are largely powerless to respond to those concerns. And luckily, when when the law was passed in 2006, the legislature, in its wisdom, also worked in a periodic review of ATCP 51. Those are the rules that we're talking about. And so this is one of those periodic reviews. A lot has changed in the last 13 years. And so Wisconsin Farmers Union believes that it's time, it's past time to update some of the things that would give local governments more latitude to respond to local concerns.
Right. In the current proposals, what kind of things would change for local governments? Because I understand it wouldn't be a drastic change allowing local governments to do whatever they wanted.
If local governments wanted to keep in place exactly what they have now, they could. But for those who, for example, see a need for greater setbacks, this would untie their hands and allow them to respond to concerns that neighbors might have. Right now in the rules, for example, a livestock operation can use part of the neighbor's property to satisfy their own setback because the setback is calculated from the nearest building and not the property line. But where the building is now may not be where someone might want to build a building in the future. And so the new proposal would allow a local government to calculate the setbacks from the neighbor's property line. That allows the neighbor to have full property rights in all of their property, not just the buildings.
Let's flesh out what we mean by setbacks. That's where, say, a manure disposal area, manure storage area, that's how close it can be to my property line or as things are to a neighbor's building.
Exactly. And in the public hearings, we heard some really compelling testimony from people who said, the manure smell is such that I can't hang laundry out on the line. I can't open my windows. And we know in a couple of documented instances that the Department of Revenue has reduced people's property values due to proximity to CAFOs and large livestock operations. And the landscape looks different than it did in 2006 when 1,000 animal units was a really large farm. Now we're seeing 5, 7, 10,000 animal unit operations. And with that comes a greater need to be responsive to neighbors and greater setbacks come along with that.
Now, a concern we heard from a dairy group, and there are others on board with this, is, you know what, this creates uncertainty for farmers. It could make it more difficult for existing, say, dairy farms who want to expand their operation a certain amount. It's an obstacle to their businesses if we make these changes. What do you say to that?
There are lots of different businesses in rural communities. And let's take, for example, the neighbor who might want to start a bed and breakfast. But if they can't expand and build a new building or a new facility closer on their property because of proximity, because part of their property is being used to satisfy a setback, that also hinders their business. And we're seeking a balance. And those are really local conditions that require a local response. And that's why these rules, these changes would untie the hands of local government to evaluate the local circumstances and balance those two interests.
Talking to Kara O'Connor from Wisconsin Farmers Union, talking about proposed changes to Wisconsin rules when it comes to various siting decisions related to livestock operations in the state. Again, with those setbacks, I think a concern that we heard again from the dairy group, Kara, is that, okay, I'm a farmer. Next door, it's a farmer. If I can't use the property line as the setback guidepost, I'm basically saying, okay, if there could hypothetically be a building there at some point in the future, that's limiting my operations. The existence of a hypothetical building there is stopping me from siting this manure disposal area where I want to.
A local government can always reduce the setback. That's the key. So if the local government understands that situation and decides that that neighbor is likely to never be anything other than a cornfield, then the opportunity is always there to reduce it. But right now, Madison is setting the ceiling, and local governments, even when the need calls for it, can't set a setback that's higher than what we have now. And we're seeing plenty of evidence that those are not always sufficient.
And you've raised the concern that Wisconsin already has overproduction of dairy in many ways, or the nation does for that matter. It's keeping commodity prices low. Do you see the rules as they are helping larger operations, maybe the expense of smaller ones?
Well, what I would say is that tough economics don't eliminate the need for us as an industry to be accountable to our neighbors and to our communities. Wisconsin Farmers Union, through our Dairy Together initiative, is looking for ways to make all farms of every size profitable at the size that they are now without the need for continual expansion. And so at DairyTogether.com, we have that research that bolsters those proposals that would enhance the profitability. And that's a key for us. We do want the dairy industry to thrive.
And there are concerns not just with the siting, as I understand, but with odor treatment, regardless of where the pit is. What goes on there with these rules when evaluating how much odor is being generated by a livestock operation?
One of the important shifts in these proposed rules is turning from the offset model, which is the model that was used previously to calculate odor and setbacks, to a straight numerical setback from property lines. The offset model that we're using now is becoming obsolete. It's not going to be supported by the developers in the future. And it's hard to enforce because it's complex. There are lots of minute details and really some elements in the current odor scoring that are scientifically questionable. That shift to straight setbacks is much easier to enforce. We know what the distance from a property line is, and it'll be more robust. It's more similar to what other states have done. And it's important to note that other states have even bigger setbacks than what are being proposed here.
Now, you're one farmers group who says, yes, let's change these rules in this way. A lot of powerful agricultural groups are saying, no, we don't want these changes. There are some state lawmakers who have said, yeah, they're going to lie down in front of the tractor on this one. They're not going to let these changes happen. Are you worried that these proposals that you're looking for are just going to be shut down ultimately?
There are some tensions that will not go away if these rules are shut down. We have rural roads that are deteriorating at a rapid pace and far faster than we are able to towns can afford to rebuild them. And heavy truck traffic is one of the single largest factors in that decline. If towns don't have a way of managing the heavy truck traffic that's coming from large livestock operations, then we're going to be in a situation where the whole industry is suffering due to lack of roads. And we're just at a crisis point with regard to our road funding, for example. We're at a crisis point with regard to our water. And one of the things that the proposed rules would do would be to allow for more frequent inspection of manure pits to make sure that they're not leaking, because we know of instances where manure pits have leaked and that manure has spread into the water table. The rules would ensure that, or would allow a local government to ensure that a facility actually has the land base that they need to accommodate the number of animals that they have in terms of manure. We don't require that now. And so that's where we get into a crunch with too much manure being spread on too few acres. Those are problems that aren't going to go away if this rule does. And so I think rather than delaying the inevitable, it only makes sense to take the opportunity that we have now to make some small steps in progress toward those concerns.
The rules are one venue to deal with some of these issues. As you said, even these would be small steps. Are there other places outside of this particular rulemaking process that you're looking at for changes along the lines of water quality, road protection, and the other things you just talked about?
Certainly. This summer, we've seen the Speaker's Water Quality Task Force hold a series of hearings all around the state. And one of the big take-homes for me was the effectiveness of grazing as a farming technique to both improve farmer profitability and improve water quality. We had a county conservationist who said, I have to tell you, grazing just blows every other practice out of the water. When we would love to see the legislature create a new grazing and organics position at DATCAP, as the governor proposed, that would really enhance the ability of farmers to adopt that practice.
Kara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Kara O'Connor, Government Relations Director at the Wisconsin Farmers Union. She was with us today to tell us why they support proposed changes to the state's livestock siting rules. Earlier this week, we heard a different perspective from the Dairy Business Association, which says these changes would hurt farmers' ability to compete with farmers in other states. If you want to listen back to that interview, you can find it online at WPR.org.